Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today I will take sutta number 19 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Dvaidavitaka Sutta, or the twofold, call it the twofold analysis of thoughts. But before I deal with the sutta itself, I just want to explain a little bit about the way the program of the course is unfolding. We're now in section 5. This is section 5 of the series of discourses on the path to liberation. And so far in section 2 of this, or division 2, the gradual training, we took a broad overview of the path with the two discourses, number 27, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, and the greater discourse at Asapura. Both these suttas give us the full view of the Buddha's graduated training, the step-by-step training, all the ways from the elementary stages to the conclusion or consummation of the path with the attainment of full liberation. And I just threw in sutta number 40, the shorter discourse at Asapura, just because it was also given at Asapura, and it seems to go along with sutta number 39. Okay, then sutta number 6, Majjhima Nikaya number 6, the Akankheya Sutta. Here, in a sense, we go back to the foundations of the path with sila, or virtue, moral discipline, since that discourse emphasizes the importance of moral discipline as the foundation of the training. But this discourse also has the added benefit of showing all the different attainments, some concisely, some in more detail, of showing all the different attainments which become possible on the foundation of moral discipline. So in the Akankheya Sutta, we get compressed together the four jhanas, compressed together the formless attainments. Then we get, for the first time in this course, the four different paths of liberation, the four noble paths, Arya Muggas, the attainment of the four stages of sanctity or holiness. And then wedged in between the third and fourth path, though I had to rush through them to finish last week, are the five abhinyas, the five higher knowledges or supernormal knowledges, the knowledge of psychic powers, the knowledge of the divine ear, the knowledge of knowing the minds of others, then the recollection of previous lives, and the divine eye, the ability to see the arising and passing away of beings. And then that is followed by the sixth direct knowledge, which is also the fourth fruition, that is arahatship. Okay, now in section 6, or section 5, which we come to right now, we will be dealing with a number of suttas which from different angles deal with the task of training and mastering the mind. Okay, and so the first sutta that we will discuss within this category is the one that we come to now, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the discourse on two kinds of thought. And the word vitakka here, which is translated thought, is also synonymous. It's synonymous with another word that comes often in the text. That word is sankappa. I'll write this. And so this sutta, the word sankappa appears in the Buddha's account of the Noble Eightfold Path. The second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is sammasankappa, which means right intention, right thought. And then often the Buddha will contrast right thought with wrong thought. Wrong thought is michasankappa. So this sutta is in a sense concerned with the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path and with how the Buddha actually discovered this factor, discovered its importance, and used it as an instrument or a technique, a method in his own process of spiritual development. And the word sankappa, or we equate it with vitakka, meaning thought, but the word sankappa introduces the idea of, I call it the intentional aspect of thought, the purposive aspect, the motivational aspect. So this is not just thought as an intellectual exercise. It's not abstract thought, thinking about philosophical problems, or it's not even thought in the sense of the thinking that goes into right understanding or right view. But this is now thought as influenced by emotional factors, dispositional factors. And these play also a crucial aspect in the training of the mind. In fact, in the development of samadhi, one has to deal principally with the emotional coloring of the mind, the emotional pressures exerted upon the mind by various thoughts which are infused with emotional values, with intentions, with purposes. And if these thoughts take the wrong track, then they can lead to inner commotion, disturbance, and inner turmoil, so that the mind does not settle down and reach samadhi or concentration. And in order to prepare the mind for concentration, one has to understand how to deal skillfully with these emotionally charged, purposively directed types of thought. Okay, so now if we turn to the sutta itself, we have the Buddha speaking about the period before his enlightenment. And in this way, the Buddha is using his pre-enlightenment experience as a teaching lesson for those who are following him and training in accordance with his own example. So now, while he was still a bodhisattva, not yet enlightened, but following the way to enlightenment, at some point it occurred to him suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. And this would seem to me to mean that the Bodhisattva has now reached a certain level of discovery in his training, where he's coming now out of this conviction that the way to liberation lies through these grueling, difficult ascetic practices. And he now realizes that the true path lies in the training of the mind. And it's not a sudden enlightenment that comes out of nowhere, but it comes through this graduated and methodical understanding and training of the mind. So now he says, let me set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of, here it's translated cruelty, but vihingsa means more harming other living beings. I think cruelty is only an extreme form of this vihingsa, where one actually gets pleasure and delight from harming others. But there could be cases of somebody who just, maybe with hardly any thought, just harms other beings. Like a person who he gets a mosquito on his arm and, you know, he just doesn't give much thought to the fact that the mosquito is a living being also, so just almost half mindfully, with kind of half awareness, he just takes his hand, slaps the mosquito, and brushes it off. He's not being deliberately cruel to the mosquito, or at least there's no cruel component in the mind. Though from the mosquito's point of view, of course, he's being extremely cruel. But it's just the intention of harming. Okay, so on the one side, he puts thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. And on the other side, he puts thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of, here we render it quite literally, non-ill will, and thoughts of harmlessness, non-harming, non-injury, non-cruelty. Okay, so now the Buddha makes this division between two classes of thoughts. They call these the unwholesome. And these thoughts, they actually form three pairs of opposites. Yeah, the thought that is rendered renunciation. You see, in the original language, the exact meaning could have been ambiguous, because the thought of sensuality is kama vitaka. Okay, now the negation of that would be nikama, which means without sensuality. And so it's just quite possible that the original was nikama, but there's another word, nakama, which means renunciation. And when one gives up sensuality, it's an act of renunciation. The word nakama has nothing to do with the root kama, but it comes from the root kum, which means to step, to walk. I think it's probably your Chinese zhou. So it's going out. Nikamati is to go out, to step out. So the act of renunciation is stepping out, going out from the home life into homelessness. And when one does that, one does so giving up sensual pleasures. So it's possible that these two words somehow got conflated, and what was originally nikama, the lower rendering there, got turned into, that means non-sensuality, got turned into nekama, renunciation. In Sanskrit versions of texts, I believe you get both words, but in the Pali Middle Indian text, it comes down always as nekama, renunciation. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain, after making this distinction, this division in his thoughts, now he explains how he trained. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. He's not yet the Buddha, but still Bodhisattva, so occasionally, even though he's very advanced spiritually, but thoughts of sensual desire might have arisen in him, maybe recollections of his life in the palace, longing, it could be attachment to the wife. They don't have to be crude sensual thoughts, but still attachment to his wife, to his newborn child. Or it could have been just also normal sensual thoughts. But then he used this line of reflection to overcome these thoughts. And here he reflected on these thoughts. This leads to my own affliction. To my own harm. Because if he were to follow through and indulge these thoughts, then it would obstruct his own ability to gain samadhi. It would prevent him from going further on the path to enlightenment. And then there would be no Buddha in the world. It leads to others' affliction. Since, let's just put it in general terms, not in relation to the Buddha himself, to others' affliction. So if one surrenders to these thoughts of sensuality, then they will take possession of one's own mind. One's own mind becomes dominated by sensual thoughts. And again, it prevents the mind from gaining this calm and peace and from advancing towards samadhi or concentration. Then, since it leads to one's own harm, to the harm of others, naturally, logically, it leads to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom. That is, it's panya nirodhika, which means actually that it blocks wisdom. It causes wisdom to cease. So even if one has already developed some panya, some wisdom, if one then surrenders to sensual thoughts, sensual fantasies, if one acts on these thoughts, then the courseway leading to the strengthening, to the evolution, development of wisdom is obstructed. Then the sensual thought causes difficulties, or the Pali word vigata means actually it's closer to affliction. It causes trouble for oneself, internal frustration, vexation. And then it leads away from Nibbana. Since Nibbana, the ultimate liberation, has to be achieved by completely overcoming sensual desire. And so now the Buddha explains, having first understood these facts about this thought that has arisen. Now the Buddha explains how he uses each of these considerations as a means, a method for eliminating the thought of sensuality. So he takes each of these themes. First, he takes the theme that the thought leads to my own affliction. And when he focused on that theme, that idea, then the sensual thought subsided in him. So if one uses this technique, just reflecting that the sensual thought is harmful to oneself, that becomes a strong motivation, like a whip, to push the thought away from one's own mind. And then through one's consideration for the good of others, maybe some people don't care what happens to themselves, but they will think, have concern for the well-being of others. And so one wants to protect others, and so one reflects that when this thought arises in me, then it will cause me to act in ways that will be harmful to others. So if people involved in pornography, the sex trade, even advertising, which is provocative of intense sensual desires, if they were to consider in this way, reflect in this way, then it would help to eliminate these nefarious types of trades and bring a great change in the world of commerce. But instead, people realize that they can stimulate stimulate the flow of the economy, stimulate business by appealing to people's lower instincts, by arousing sensual desire. One of these recorders just made a beeping sound. Does that mean the... Okay, anyway, I'll just go on speaking. Okay, so another theme is to reflect on how the sensual thought leads to others' affliction. And then the third way is just to bring in both, to consider that it leads to the affliction of both oneself and others. Either one, two, or three, either of these three ways sometimes is enough by itself to make the thought subside. And if one brings, you could bring the first two together with the third theme, and that sometimes is sufficient. Then the next three are all taken together, that this thought obstructs wisdom, it causes difficulties, it leads away from Nibbana. And then when one brings up this theme, this topic, then the thought subsides. So in this way, the Buddha says, whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. Okay, now he repeats the same thing for a thought of ill will. When a thought of ill will arose in me. Here one could see that a thought of ill will, when it arises within oneself, it leads to one's own affliction, since the thought of ill will brings a lot of distress, disturbance to the mind, brings tenseness of the muscles, it brings a dark mood, cloudy mood to the mind. It makes one's facial appearance rough and ugly, so other people see you and they feel even frightened when they see an angry, aggressive person. And one doesn't win friends, And when one is, the mind is overcome by ill will, one cannot think clearly. One easily gets angry, and so one will sometimes do things suddenly, rashly, that one will later regret. And so in this way, the thought of ill will brings one's own affliction. And the thought of ill will also lead to the affliction of others. When it's still in the thought stage, it doesn't lead directly to the affliction of others. But when that thought builds up strength and then expresses itself through action, some types of physical action, some type of harsh speech, then it will cause harm to others, pain to others. And it will also bring the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. And so one could take each of these themes as a separate line of reflection to overcome that unwholesome thought. And the same with a thought of harming or cruelty. It's hard to understand how a thought of ill will or cruelty could arise in the Bodhisattva, considering that he had, at least according to Buddhist tradition, developed loving kindness and compassion over such a long time. The commentary gives a rather unconvincing explanation that he doesn't actually have thoughts of, say, harming or cruelty himself, but he sees animals in the forest fighting each other, and so he's witnessing their cruelty, and then he reflects on the dangers in cruelty. Okay, then in paragraph 6, here the Buddha gives he lays down an important principle and gives some important advice. He expresses it in terms of a bhikkhu, but it's really applicable to anybody. He says, whatever a bhikkhu, or I would say whatever any person frequently thinks and ponders, that will become the inclination of his mind. Yeah, the Pali is tatta tatta nati hoti chetaso. Thus is the bending or inclination of his mind. So what I see in this statement is that the way thoughts develop and become features of one's character, like one's character doesn't just blossom fully all at once in one form or another, but the character builds up gradually through the slow accumulation of thoughts. And so first one thinks and ponders upon certain thoughts occasionally, but then one might take a liking to those thoughts. And so those thoughts then become habitual. One then starts thinking them frequently. And each time one thinks the thought, it makes a groove within the mind. Somewhat like a little trickle stream of water flowing over stone. And if you see a creek and you'll see a slab of stone, and then you'll see a groove in the stone where a little streamlet of water has been flowing for a long time, and by flowing for a long time in that over that same slab of stone, it's worn out the stone so that there is a groove in the stone. So it's not just the water that flows in 1 hour or in 1 day which has worn out the stone, but it's that water flowing day after day, year after year, maybe century, over a century or longer, that can wear out the stone. And so in the same way, it's the thoughts that we think and ponder, these become the bent or inclination of the mind. And we think these thoughts repeatedly in the course of one day, one month, one year, and they build up a momentum, they become the constituting factors of our character. And those thoughts, they gain the upper hand, and then they become the force that builds up our character in the next life. And then the thoughts we think in that life become the constituent factors, the composing factors that build up our character for the life after that. And in this way, our character, life after life, is built up by these individual thoughts trickling through the mind. And so if one frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of sensual desire, then one gives up the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and the mind inclines the thoughts of sensual desire. If one frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, then one has abandoned the thought of harmlessness to cultivate the thought of harming, and then one's mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. And now the Buddha gives a simile. He says, just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. In those days, punishment sometimes could be very severe, even for a careless cowherd. And so in this last month of the rainy season, the crops are now very thick, and so the cows could be easily tempted to stray off to the crops and to eat them. And the farmers who are growing the crops, they depend on their livelihood for these crops. And so if the cows eat the crops, the farmers will be deprived of their livelihood. And so the cowherd has to be very careful, constantly to be watching the cows. If they threaten to go and to eat the crops, he has to hit them with a stick to keep them under control. And so the Buddha says, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. And so this is, well, so far he's really dealt only with the danger, degradation, and defilement in unwholesome states. That when these unwholesome thoughts arise, they lead one into courses, to ways that bring affliction to oneself, to others, and both, and which keep one trapped within this bondage of defilements. But now he comes to the positive side. He says, as I dwelt thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. The thought of renunciation is the thought of coming out of this bondage of sensuality, a thought of freedom from the grip of sensual desire. Already the Buddha is living a life of renunciation, but now he gets a glimpse of the freedom that comes when one is completely overcome, completely eradicated sensuality. And so when that thought arises, he understands that this thought of renunciation, it's expressed somewhat negatively, that it does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. But now, more positively, it aids wisdom. It is the panya vudiko. Yeah, that's a good expression. Panya vudiko. It causes wisdom to grow. It promotes the growth of wisdom. It is because wisdom arises in a mind which has been brought to a state of calm concentration, a mind which is clear, tranquil, serene. And so when the mind is free from the grip of sensuality, when it has this sense of openness, of spaciousness that comes with renunciation, then there's an opportunity for wisdom to grow. And the thought of renunciation is avigata pakiko, that is, it is on the side of non-difficulty or non-obstruction, non-disturbance, non-distress. It does not cause distress or difficulties. Difficulties, not so good. Difficulties could be like outer difficulties, but here vigata is inner distress. So when one generates and nurtures this thought of renunciation, this thought of detachment, of letting go, then one becomes free from inner distress, inner turmoil, inner disturbance. And this thought of renunciation is conducive to nibbana. It leads to nibbana. Nibbana sangvataniko. It evolves towards nibbana. Nibbana is the ultimate renunciation. Okay, so now the Buddha says, he was reflecting and he considers, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a whole night, even for a whole day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So now this seems to show that in this period, the Buddha... Well, let me just continue. Okay, so it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness. That's a rather awkward, let us say more simply. I unified it. Ekodi karomi. I made it unified. I unified it and concentrated it, brought it to samadhi. Why is that? So that my mind would not be disturbed. Okay, so this shows that in this period, this would be the period apparently leading up to his enlightenment, the Buddha was going through this double process. For some time, some periods, he would take these thoughts reflect upon them, and then consider the benefits in these wholesome thoughts, even considerably exploring the benefits at considerable length, using thought and examination, vitakka and vichara, to investigate and examine and reflect upon the benefits of these wholesome types of thought. And this becomes a way of strengthening and reinforcing the wholesome thoughts. But when one does this constantly, one is using a lot of thought. And if one is sitting in, say, in a meditation posture or walking back and forth, and then using a lot of thought, even though it's beneficial, it helps to strengthen that wholesome disposition of the mind. But still, the mind becomes tired, and the body also can become tired through this mental activity. So the Buddha would then periodically just draw the mind back from this exercise and reflection, examination, and then just draw the mind into a state of stillness and concentration. And this seems to show an interesting sidelight on the Buddha's enlightenment. Usually we get this sort of very dramatic story of as though the Buddha didn't do any preparatory work beforehand. He had just was taking the wrong path. Suddenly he discovers the right path, takes food, sits down in one night, and suddenly he goes into the four jhanas, then the three higher knowledges, then in full enlightenment. But here, it seems that he was actually, perhaps over some time, undertaking a methodical training of the mind. And so he had to go through this process of reflection, then stilling the mind. Reflection, stilling, reflection, stilling. Okay, then he uses the same process of reflection with regard to the thoughts of non-ill will, or we could put this more positively, thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of benevolence, and then thoughts of non-harming, non-cruelty. More positively, this would be thoughts of compassion. With regard to each of these types of wholesome thoughts, he would reflect on the benefits in them. Then after reflecting on the benefits, he draws the mind away, brings the mind inside, quiets the mind, unifies it, concentrates it, till the mind again gets steady in samadhi. Then he would return to this reflection. And now he repeats the same principle, but now with regard to the wholesome thoughts. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If we frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, then he abandons the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and the mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of benevolence or goodwill, upon thoughts of harmlessness or compassion, then one abandons the thoughts of ill will, the thoughts of harmfulness, and the mind inclines to benevolence, to goodwill, or to harmlessness, to compassion. So this is good practical advice that really should be applied. Don't just read it and then you think the only way to meditate is to be aware of the breath or to be aware of rising and falling of thoughts. But one could also do very, very important, effective fundamental meditations by taking these thoughts, examining them, and reflecting on the disadvantages, the harmfulness of the unwholesome thoughts, and then the benefits, the beauty, the nobility of the wholesome thoughts. Okay, now with regard to the wholesome thoughts, the Buddha uses a simile. He says that this is like in the last month of the hot season. Now all the crops have been brought inside the villages, and so the cow herd, he still is taking care of the cows, and he say the cow herd is at the root of the tree or out in the open, and so the cow herd can relax and take it easy. He only has to be vaguely mindful that the cows are there, that they don't go astray. He doesn't have to be worried about the cows eating the crops anymore, because the crops have all been taken inside. So with the wholesome thoughts, one doesn't have to be so vigilant, so alert and diligent. One only has to be mindful that these wholesome thoughts are there. That might be the case with the Buddha, but with us, we also have to be very alert, vigilant, and diligent, to be heedful, to be sure that the wholesome thoughts are still there. Of course, I don't know about you, but with me, if the vigilance relaxes a little bit, then the unwholesome thoughts start coming up, sometimes in subtle disguises. Okay, so now, after the Buddha explains how he firmly established the wholesome thoughts, now there comes this whole sequence describing his enlightenment. This is the same passage we already came across in Sutta number 4. First, he says that his energy was aroused, his mindfulness is established, the body becomes tranquil, untroubled, the mind concentrated and unified, and now he enters the four jhanas. Now he goes into the three vijas, the three higher knowledges, till at the end of the last vija, the last true knowledge, he directly knows kina jati, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. So this we've already explained in dealing with earlier suttas, and this was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. And now the Buddha uses a really beautiful simile that, for me, the most convincing part of the suttas, the part that, for me, establishes that these suttas have to come from a fully enlightened person, are the similes. Okay, here's the simile, and it's one that should be very meaningful for us who live at this monastery or who know this monastery, since we often have herds of deer grazing around. Though I haven't seen them, very many of them, the last few weeks. I don't know why. Okay, suppose, monks, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared, desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage. He closed off the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set out a dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. It seems he must have some fenced-in area where he wants to trap the deer. And so he puts maybe a statue of a deer, a carved deer. He sets this up as a decoy, something that will make the deer seem that this is a safe place. Now, there must be some tricks to the art of catching deer that are being referred to here. Okay, so this is the tricks, the techniques of this evil-minded man who wants to destroy the deer, catch them, kill them, use their flesh for meat, to sell the meat. Okay, then another man comes along desiring the good welfare and protection of the deer. And he reopens the safe and good path that leads to the happiness of the deer. Then he closes off the false path. He removes the decoy, destroys the dummy, so that this large herd of deer might later, they're now saved from disaster. They're now free to roam about in the open again. And so their numbers can increase and they're fruitful and they can multiply and they can live happily. So now the Buddha applies the simile. He says, I have made up the simile in order to convey a meaning. And this is the meaning. Okay, the great low-lying marsh, this is a term, a designation for sensual pleasures. And the large herd of deer is a term for sentient beings. Then that man who desires their rune, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. Here when the texts speak about Mara Papima, the evil one, it's referring to a real, I think it's referring to a real living being of some sort, a kind of demonic being who's not, it's not just a symbol, not just a metaphor, but it's a being that maybe manifests itself as some detrimental force that originates outwardly, but it permeates our minds. It seems to have a way of entering the minds of all unenlightened beings, leading to lead them astray. And Mara doesn't want the being, he's not like the Christian devil, he doesn't want to bring beings to hell. But he wants to keep them in bondage to samsara. That's his purpose. And he throws open for them this wrong path, which is the wrong eightfold path, the path of wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, action, livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness and concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. That is what, apparently, so the decoy for catching the deer, probably it's referring mainly to the male deer, the ones to be captured, and the decoy might be a model, an image of a female deer, maybe using some chemical substance that emits the smell, maybe caught and removed from a dead female deer in order to, I don't know if that will work, in order to mislead the male deer. And then the dummy, it seems to fit the English word dummy quite well, is a term for ignorance. Then the man who desires the good welfare and protection of the deer, this is a term, a designation, a symbol for the Buddha, the Tathagata. And the safe and good path is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path with its eight factors. And then so the Buddha says, so the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me. The wrong path, the path that leads into the harm, destruction, ruin, and bondage, that path has been closed off. The decoy of delight and lust has been removed. The dummy is destroyed. And now the Buddha gives the advice that he gives so often. He says, what should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, monks, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. And that is what the Buddha said. And that is the end of the discourse. It's actually, structurally, it's quite a simple discourse, but like so many of the Buddha's discourses, even though the words are simple, the meaning is simply stated, but first it's very, very practically useful, and also the implications are very profound in terms of our own, their application to our own life. Okay, if there's any questions, comments, please feel welcome. Peter? Yeah.
Are we supposed to assume from this that at a certain point before he became the Buddha, he became sure, or is he just saying this? And as the Buddha, he knows
about. Oh, I see.
There was a period he tried this.
Yeah. These teachers. That's a good question.
What was that point where he recollected when the jhana? Yeah. Said, oh,
yeah.
Is this the way to get yeah. this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think he would have had some, I call it some intuition that this is the way to Nibbana. But I think he could not be absolutely, absolutely sure until he had actually taken that path all the ways to the end and reached the goal. So I think he's now, from his own, sort of retrospectively, from his position as the Buddha, he's speaking about the way. That's just the way he would have reflected if he had that knowledge at the time. But at the time, I would assume that he had some intuitive sense that this would be the way to Nibbana. But he couldn't yet be absolutely certain of it until it was done, yeah.
Yeah. So, looking at paragraph 8, just as it is, it seems that when you look at preparing what he was saying about he spent all this time thinking about the drawbacks to it.
Yeah.
When you look at paragraph 8, it almost seems like, I guess he spends time looking, reflecting on it. Are we to spend some time thinking about it and then stills his mind? When I read this, the first few times I read this, it seemed like, well, he dwells on the drawback to the negative thoughts and then doesn't dwell on the positive thoughts at all.
No. From paragraph 8, it seems clear to me that he dwells on the benefits in the positive thoughts. So he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my mind.
Okay, so that's saying that he thinks about it, but he doesn't just say, okay, well, I'm just going to continually think about it.
Right. He doesn't...
there's a drawback at some point.
Yeah, he dwells upon it for some time, I think, in order to strengthen, to reinforce the wholesome disposition in the mind. But at a certain point, the mind starts to become tired. And then one has to draw back from that. We don't have to put it in terms of what the Buddha is doing, but this is just as practical exercise. This is what I found also, that it's useful to do this type of reflection as a way of to reflect upon the unsatisfactoriness, the drawbacks in the unwholesome types of thoughts, and the benefits in the wholesome types of thoughts. And one is sitting there as a meditation, and one works out a particular scheme. One doesn't just do it at random, but one has First one sits at the desk, maybe with a pencil and paper, and writes out a number of, say, disadvantages, maybe 3 disadvantages, 4 disadvantages, and each unwholesome thought. 3, 4 benefits in each of the wholesome types of thoughts. And then one goes through it contemplatively as a meditation, a meditative exercise for a certain period of time. It could be even just 5-10 minutes. One just goes through as an exercise, considering, turning over in the mind the drawbacks in the unwholesome thoughts, the benefits in the wholesome thoughts. Well, after 5 or 10 minutes, the mind won't get tired. But if one does it 15-20 minutes, the mind will start to get tired. And then one has to draw back from that type of reflection and then bring the mind back. If one doesn't have the ability to go into this internal quietness, singleness, and concentration, but one just lets go of this discursive contemplation and brings the mind to an object which is more restful, like the in and out breathing, or the rise and fall of the abdomen, something that will help the mind just settle and become quiet. And then after the mind becomes quiet for some time, then one can come back and go into this reflective contemplation of the drawbacks in the unwholesome states and the benefits in the wholesome states. Yeah. It's a thematic meditation. And these are very useful, just as much, well, I can't say just as much, but they are useful as a complement to the meditations which involve stilling the mind and the meditations which involve direct observation of phenomena. Yeah, there? Yeah, that's a good question, and it's something that I've thought about. Because when we have 3 unwholesome roots, we have greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, so that, but then when we have the 3 unwholesome thoughts, we have thought of sensuality. Okay, that easily comes under greed. Greed is more than, well, lobha is more than just the Western, the English sense of greed, like wanting more, too much money, too much food. But any kind of liking, attachment is desire, strong selfish desire is lobha, greed. And so sensual thought comes under greed. Then ill will, vyapada, can be equated with hatred. So cruelty or harmfulness isn't represented by one of the unwholesome roots. And in the, even in the Abhidhamma system, it doesn't have a single mental factor of its own, at least in the Theravada Pali Abhidharma. So it seems that to me that harmfulness, harming, it's almost just like a branch, another branch of hatred, of ill will. But maybe it was mentioned by the Buddha separately because, perhaps because it leads more directly into destructive types of actions, taking the life, killing living beings, for harsh speech, cruel speech. Yeah. Because of course, ill will can also lead to bodily and verbal actions, but harmfulness seems to be more directly correlated with harmful bodily and verbal actions. And also, it was one of the big themes, subjects followed by the Buddha's contemporaries, the ascetics who were contemporary with the Buddha, was to, especially the Jains, they were strongly committed to the observance of non-harming, non-injury. That's, everybody knows the word, well not it, but many people know the word ahimsa, which means non-harming. Gandhi made that word very popular, so I think now it might even be in English dictionaries. But ahimsa is just, the Pali word is avihimsa. Vi is just, gives a little strengthening to the meaning. But it's basically from the same stem. Himsa is harming, and avihimsa is non-harming. That's my thought. Maybe does anybody else have any idea about that? Do you have any idea? Yeah, one could also draw that connection. Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Yeah, so ill will would be the wish for the, well, I would say the wish for the, well, ill will would be the wish for the non-welfare, which would be for the harm and suffering of others. Yeah. If loving kindness is the wish for the welfare and happiness of others, then its opposite, ill will, would be the wish for the harm and suffering of others. Then how would that differ from? Actually, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. That's a good way to understand it. Yeah. So ill will could just be the feeling of resentment against others, of feeling resentment, aversion, dislike for others, not yet manifesting a wish for others to have harm, to undergo harm and suffering. Whereas ill will, if it's allowed to fester inside, then easily it gives rise to that wish that others will undergo harm and suffering. Then it becomes thoughts of harming.
Is faith more on the attitude, ill will,
or the other way?
And harming is
actual. Well, we're still in the realm of thoughts or purpose, but the thought of harming seems to be a bridge or transition towards bodily and verbal action, which has destructive consequences. Well, let's say destructive bodily and verbal action. So ill will is one step away from that harmful, destructive bodily and verbal action. Well, let's say ill will is two steps away, whereas harming is just one step away. So ill will first gives rise to the impulse of harming. Then harming, the thought of harming comes to manifestation or expression in harmful bodily and verbal action. So these are our ways of explaining it, but I haven't seen the question I've dealt with either in sutta texts and even in the commentaries. I haven't seen these questions raised, an attempt made to answer them. Even the Pali commentaries just seem to take it for granted. There are these three types of thoughts, and they don't deal with the relationship between ill will and the thought of harming. At least to my knowledge, they don't. Perhaps there are passages in the commentaries that I'm not familiar with which do raise that question. But I think if there were, I would have come across them already. But sometimes the questions would seem most obvious to us. The questions would seem to us most in need of answers. The commentators don't even raise, they just take for granted that, or they don't even see a problem there. They don't even see the need to raise questions. So it's good to bring these questions up and if we had a computer which sent messages not over distance but back in time, we could send them to commentators in the 4th century or even earlier, ask them to think about those questions and put new answers in the commentaries, then send them back forward in time to us 14, 15 centuries later. Any further questions? Okay, then we will close for the day, for the night. And next week we take Sutta number 20, Vitaka Santana Sutta. Okay, we do the sharing of the merits. First with the devas, then with the nagas, dragon spirits, then with all sentient beings, inviting them to rejoice in the merits and to protect the Buddha's teaching, the exposition of the teaching, and ourselves and others. Then we invite the devas, the buddhas or harmful spirits, and the saktas, all sentient beings, to rejoice in the merits, and by sharing in the merits, may they achieve all success. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhe sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhe sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati.